Hello and welcome to Presenting, a podcast where we chat about various topics related to role-playing games, typically Paizo products such as Pathfinder and Starfinder, but also others. I am John Godek, and with me today is Scott Young. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Scott is a freelance author who has multiple writing credits for both Pathfinder and Starfinder from publishers including Paizo, Legendary Games, Flaming Crab Games, and John Brazier Enterprises. He also has written and edited for the Wayfinder fan magazine. So, Scott, can you talk a little bit about your journey to becoming a freelancer?
Yeah, you know, it all sort of started, just through gaming. I was starting a new gaming group and wanted to play this new thing called Pathfinder I had discovered. And nobody around me was playing it. So I started our local Pathfinder Society Lodge in the organized play program there. And started building up a little gaming group. And from there, I heard about PaizoCon and had to go to PaizoCon and just had a brilliant time. And I fell in love with the game system, with the people that I met, with the company. It was just sort of a real game changer for me discovering things. That was about like 2011 or so. Mm-hmm. And so I'm running these games and I get an email from this guy saying, "Oh, cool. I didn't know anybody was running any of these adventures here in Winnipeg. I should drop by sometime." Signed Thurston Hillman, who's Thirsty is well known in the gaming community, both here in Winnipeg and around the world at this point. Thurston's local to me. And so I got to know him and realized, what do you mean? You can write games from Winnipeg? You don't have to be in Seattle. You don't have to be in a big center. And I got the opportunity actually to write something for PaizoCon's 2012 Grand Convocation event. It was basically this big event with a bunch of games and a bunch of LARP stuff and a bunch of in-character story things. It was this massive thing that happened, and I got to write a quest for that, and people played it, and I ran it for people at PaizoCon, and I was just kind of blown away with how that process went, and it just got me really excited to do more and more of it. And unfortunately, it's a little harder to get into, you know, starting at the top with Paizo. It's a little hard to, you know, just jump in there. Mm-hmm. But I started, you know, just honing my craft. And then the Aethera campaign setting came along, Robert Brooks.
Right.
And I mean, Robert is probably responsible for making half of the freelancers that are out there right now doing stuff actively, because he's just such a great mentor and sort of guiding light. And it was just fantastic working with him. He gave me a whole bunch of pieces to do for Aethera, and I got my name on a book, and I went through the whole process of, it's not just writing for your own gaming table. It's not just writing for, you know, an outline and then you're going to wing it when you get your players around the table. It's a lot more involved, and going through that process, that's where people either decide that they love it or they get scared off. And I didn't get scared off. So I've been pretty much doing it ever since.
Wow. You know, I did not realize that you were that close to Thirsty up there. And it's funny because was he actually, at the time, was he working as a developer for Paizo?
He was just a freelancer. Well, just a freelancer at the time. Yeah. He had just done his second Pathfinder Society project and was starting to get into the hardcover books and campaign setting and stuff like that. So it was just, they were calling him a rising star at the time. So, he was a great ally, of course. And once he was working there and became the, you know, Starfinder developer, and now he's the digital adventures developer, I guess is the title. You know, I'm sure it didn't hurt my career to have someone, you know, right there to be able to advocate for me and stuff like that. So,
no, it's neat. And when you went to PaizoCon, that was pretty early on in PaizoCon's history, still, right?
I'm an old guy, and I guess I discovered Pathfinder Society in 20. We founded the Winnipeg Lodge in 2010, and so I guess that was like season one or whatever of Pathfinder One.
That's like really early.
It was really early. And Thurston had written something for that season that was just an epic adventure. And I had made some 3D terrain for it. That's something that I mm-hmm. used to spend a lot of time, you know, when we would get together in person to play games. And so I made 3D terrain for that particular scenario. And you build this community and you start getting to know other people. You go to PaizoCon, you get introduced to this person who introduces you to that person. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the people that you only read about in the credits of your favorite game or on a website where they're writing articles or things like that, suddenly you're hanging out with them and they're talking to mm-hmm. you like you're a real person. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah. So is it still pretty active lodge up there in Winnipeg?
You know, COVID has taken its toll for sure. I mean, once you start going online, in some ways, the need for the local lodge is lessened a little bit because people are able to find games anywhere. And that makes it really good for the individual, but I think it loses a little bit of the group cohesion kind of thing. But we've had ups and downs. At our peak, we were running something like 18 games a week. And it was insane. We were the biggest lodge outside of the United States for a couple of years running, sort of at the peak in I don't know, maybe 2014, something like that. Yeah, it was incredible just because we had so many people that were joining us, and we were doing a lot of active outreach. Like you can't just run games for your friends. If you want to grow a lodge and grow a community, you really have to be out there at the cons and running that same introductory adventure over and over again, because it's brand new to those kids that just dropped in. Right. So,
Well, this is a kind of a neat historical context I wasn't familiar with. That's why I'm kind of curious about that.
Yeah.
So you started off writing for first edition, it sounds like.
I got to do a quest for, that was sort of how they were doing it at the time. They would get a scenario that would have five individual quests. Right. And so I got to do one of those. And after I turned it in, I got asked to do a full scenario, which was really cool. And then Thurston asked me to do a Starfinder one. And I don't play nearly as much Starfinder or run nearly as much Starfinder as I do Pathfinder. I'm not really a one game system person, but I focus, I guess. So it was a big challenge to sort of feel confident enough to run to put it all together and make sure it mechanically worked. But from a storytelling point of view, it's actually really cool. Starfinder has so many opportunities for great stories and great characters and NPCs and things like that. And it was a lot of fun. And so now
that was Acts of Association, that one?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that is actually one of the neater first season scenarios, and I've run it probably four or five times. Yeah, the only thing I don't like about it, I'll tell you this, is the size of that darn map.
Oh, I know. you get stuck. Not stuck, but you get recommended. Yeah. You know, use Maps Imprint or that kind of thing. The way I tend to run games, it tends to be very sandboxy. Like when I'm running even a Pathfinder scenario or Society scenario, I'll put out a map for the inn that they're meeting at, even if nothing happens there. I like to, you know, just have big spaces out there to give players, because you never know what the players are going to do, right? So I guess when I write, I tend to keep that in mind as well.
Well, it's funny because, you know,
So Acts of Association.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, I GM a lot in person or did before the pandemic. And I always print out the maps and have a full-size printed color map.
Nice.
And that is, like, outside of the APs, that is the biggest map I have.
Yeah, yeah. So. There's the maps, and then there's the I've actually played Acts of Association a couple times, once or twice incognito, and then once Alex Spidell from Paizo was running it at a con, and I asked him if it was okay for me to sign up for the game, but it's amazing how different it runs based on the GM. Mm-hmm. You've got some people that will sort of follow the outline very carefully and add neat little things. And then you've got folks like Alex that will basically say, well, I'm keeping the title. I'm pretty much changing everything else. And because it's a repeatable, you want that kind of variety, right? With the different NPCs and diplomats and things like that. So, yeah.
Well, neat. So you did that one, right? And then did you go start doing more Pathfinder or?
Yeah, you know, I flipped back and forth. So yeah, I sort of flip-flopped back and forth. I did the one Starfinder and then went back to Pathfinder, and Pathfinder 2 came out and I started doing some stuff there. So I think I my last one was, I think my seventh organized play scenario was The Lost Maid of Anactoria in Pathfinder 2. So that was a really fun one. I love Ustalav. That's where my heart is from Galarian, and that was just such a fun scenario to work on. I think that you know, as I've moved into, you know, other kinds of things, I've done some back matter for one of the APs, and I've done some little bits and bobs for other projects that are coming up. I think I'll keep sort of flipping back and forth between Pathfinder and Starfinder. Sort of, you want to take, as a freelancer, you want to take whatever comes up that is in your wheelhouse. And even if it's not in your wheelhouse, as long as you're not, you know, juggling too many projects at once, it's a good way to make it your wheelhouse, to expand your wheelhouse and move into different game systems. Because, I mean, if you want to do a lot of freelancing, there are only so many people out there willing to pay you to do it, and only so many opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned that you were more focused on Pathfinder. I'm kind of the reverse. I've been really focused on Starfinder for a long time up until recently. Now I'm getting into second edition. And so consequently, most of my writing is all Starfinder, but I want to get into Pathfinder. So now I figured I should start playing it a lot more. You know?
Yeah. That's something that, I mean, some people can write for a system without playing it a lot. But I do find that, you know, having a lot of GM experience, a lot of play experience in the various systems really helps to, you know, anticipate what players might do or notice those little synergies of feats or things like that can cause problems.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've done work in several different systems here. So first edition, second edition, Starfinder, and for several different companies. What are some of the challenges that this is presented with you, both the systems and working with different companies?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, first is scheduling. You want to say yes to everybody, but you know, you have to look at the deadlines and make sure you physically have time. I'm not doing this full time. I've got a wife and two kids, and I've got a day job and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you got to make sure you don't pack yourself in too much and then wind up having to pull out of something. But to be honest, for me, again, as a slightly older guy whose memory is maybe not the best, it's remembering the slight differences between different systems. Mm-hmm. You know, you're working on something in Pathfinder 2, and then you're converting something from Pathfinder 1 to D&D 5th edition for Legendary Games or something like that.
Right.
I mean, none of those systems are the same, but there are elements that are close enough that it's easy to mix up. So I tend to look everything up. That's pretty much my rule when I'm doing a conversion or writing. I just make sure that I look everything up and I don't trust my memory. And that's pretty much the only way to keep it all straight.
I like that. I've done some of these conversions that you're talking about, and I think that's a really smart bit of advice. And you're the first person I've heard say something like that. So I think that's awesome. Now, one of the things I want to say is you keep mentioning your age. I'm pretty sure I'm a lot older than you. So you need to quit talking like that. Well, you still have young kids. And my youngest is starting grad school at UBC. So
okay. Well, I got started late. I was too busy gaming when I was young. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the most iconic Starfinder Society scenarios out there from season one was Live Exploration Extreme. And you were tasked to do the follow-up to that in season three called Live Adventure Extreme. Now, I actually was fortunate to have played both games run by the author. So John Compton with the first one, and then you in December actually ran 310 at our Emerald Con. And the question I have for you is, you know, when you're writing something that follows such an iconic and well-loved scenario with some, you know, well-known NPCs and stuff, how challenging is that?
Well, it was really challenging. It was terrifying, to be quite honest. I mean, if I had to pick heroes in this field, I mean, John Compton would be near the top. And, you know, that scenario with Zoe and the whole, you know, sort of subgenre of that scenario is just, like you say, so iconic. And then, I mean, Jenny Jarzabski did some stuff in season two that used Zoe and introduced some of the game show host characters. And she's someone that I admire incredibly as well. And so I called up Jenny and said, hey, what kind of insight can you give me on these characters? I want to portray them faithful to your original vision, kind of thing. I didn't quite have the guts to call up John Compton, but so it was, I felt that it was really important to not just take things and then just run with them and just put my own stamp on it. I really wanted to sort of, you know, honor the history and honor the stuff that had already been established. And that's probably my museum background talking. That's my day job. Mm-hmm. I work at a museum, but, I think it was really important to not make things feel different. You know, you want people to come back to a Zoe scenario and say, oh yeah, it's Zoe. And oh yeah, there's the assistant whose name I always forget. And there's the two talk show hosts. And it feels like a sequel, and there's still progression. There's still new things, but it feels like the same characters. And that's always tough when you've got, you know, different GMs running different games and things like that. So the scenario can really establish that in people's minds, I think, the way you write it.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I forgot that Jane wrote Packworld Warriors, which also used some same characters, because it wasn't that this live whatever extreme kind of thing.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So it was same basic idea. Now at that time, Jenny, was she still freelancing, or was she?
Yeah, she was still freelancing at the time. Yeah. It's amazing. So, you know, basically, you know, the crew of freelancers has sort of, you know, turned it into a full-time job kind of thing, which is pretty incredible.
Well, oftentimes, except for Thirsty, apparently, you're required to make the move, right?
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, Thirsty defies the rules in so many ways you know, yeah, he's definitely a special case. But I mean, I think what I would hope is that kind of experience is probably getting easier in the world now. We've just demonstrated that you can do so much of it remotely. Like I haven't been in my office at my museum for a year now. And, you know, the only people that have noticed are the cleaning staff, because they have less work to do. So I think we're, you know, especially with something like freelancing or gaming, where there's so much collaboration across the country and with different people in different time zones anyway, it's ripe for that kind of work.
Yeah, I think I would imagine with them, and Ron Lundeen is a good friend of mine, and we talk quite a bit about how things work and everything. I think it's a lot the in-person synergies they get when they're, you know, when they're pitching ideas for seasons and adventure paths and things like that. I think they just get a lot more out of it face to face, or they feel that way. So that's kind of why they want to do it. Because like as soon as things started to open up, it looked like they started to start making the shift back to in person again.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think you can't quite replicate a lot of the big idea kind of stuff. There's nothing that quite beats, you know, having 10 people around a big table with a bunch of pizza and sodas and 3 a.m. conversation kind of thing. But in terms of like the day-to-day stuff or the freelance kind of stuff, I think works really well. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I think for freelancers, it's actually ideal. The idea that Thirsty's a developer in, you know, with that situation. But I think the idea is that he works the other coast or the North Coast more, you know, so he goes to conventions out that way and does you know, to kind of help justify that situation.
Well, so, I remember when I started as a venture officer, Mike Brock was in charge of the organized play program, and Mike had sort of this little cabal of a few people, his own little decemvirate that he would talk to. And Thirsty was like right into that. And I think Thurston's sort of been, you know, he's good friends with all the Paizo people before he started working there.
Right.
You know, he's just got, like I've sat at his table a number of times. He's just got so many good ideas. Like, oh my gosh, it's So, I mean, certainly if you're going to make exceptions,
for sure. Yeah. I was actually surprised with Jenny that, you know, cause she was far away, it was the middle of a pandemic that she moved as early as she did. You know,
Well, I mean, they let her wait for a little while, but it's one of those things, I guess, where, when you're moving, you kind of got to, you know, when you can right. find a place and when you can
right.
get out there. Yeah. That's a big move, but yeah. And you know, there was a point where I was thinking, you know, that'd be a job that I would apply for if it came up and stuff like that. So, I mean, but you know, I think I'm pretty settled here in Winnipeg, and actually we've got such an active, freelance mm-hmm. and gaming community here that we kind of punch above our weight class already. So there's a lot of benefits to being here. I think we've got 5 or 6 Paizo freelancers here in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. and people working for a bunch of other companies, you know, within an hour of here. So
yeah, no, that's yeah. I've not been to Winnipeg. My daughter actually went to school in Alberta. So
oh yeah, she's, okay.
And she, going to UBC coming up. So I've only been that far and actually interviewed for University of Alberta, and I had an invite up to Manitoba, but didn't take it yeah. for an interview. So
oh, yeah, cool.
I could have seen the place.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. Yeah. It's often, you know, people from the West will hit BC and Alberta, and yeah. then you sort of skip over the prairies and then you fly right to Toronto or Montreal. Yeah. You know, we're kind of used to that. But... Yeah. Yeah. It's
sorry.
It's kind of like, you know, best kept secrets, and that's yeah. totally fine. Yeah.
So what advice do you have for people interested in kind of getting into freelance writing for RPGs, especially for Paizo?
Well, you know, I mean, the first thing is to write. I mean, don't wait for an assignment to write. Just give yourself assignments and write, because the thing that you're going to be doing is generating words and then revising and editing and hating them and smashing your head against the wall and then writing more and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. the better that first draft comes out, the more efficient you are. So the more that you're able to spew words on things that you know, and sure, you might have to look up rules, or you might have to right. you know, play around with, for me it's names of characters. I always pick mm. names last mm-hmm. because I just can't do those spur of the moment. But mm-hmm. The more you write, the better your craft will be, and then when you get, you know, that first shot, you'll be ready for it, rather than, you know, I get a lot of people that'll be like, oh yeah, I want to sign up to do a quest, or I'm going to submit to one of these open calls. Well, what have you written? Well, nothing yet, but I got all these ideas. And right, I think it was right, Jason right. Bowman that said something like, you know, everybody's got ideas. Ideas are not what companies pay for, because mm-hmm. everybody at the company has a bazillion ideas already. They want mm-hmm. someone who can take an idea and mm-hmm. turn it into game mechanics and lore on mm-hmm. time, and that's what you're getting paid for. You're not getting right. paid for ideas.
Interesting. I actually like that perspective a lot, because I think a lot of folks, when they think about freelancing, that's what they consider. And for me, I didn't really think about freelancing a lot, because I didn't think I was super creative. You know, I always wanted to be a writer, but every time I would try, and this is like long ago, like writing short stories and novels, it was really hard just to think of things to write. But I'm really good with rules and mechanics. Mm-hmm. And that's what I realized. So I've written for a bunch of hardcovers now, because right. that's what I'm really good at. I would like, though, to get into more stories now. But unfortunately, I seem to be pigeonholed as a hardcover person, mechanics person right now. So I'm getting into back matter.
Yeah, so. That's what I'm trying to do is yeah. You know, I've done all these society scenarios, and I'm finally jumping across to the to the hardcovers and the AP lines and things like that. So mm-hmm. you do tend to, you know, you dance with the one that brung you. And so, exactly. you know, yeah. that's where the jobs come from. But then once you have done something that you can show people and mm-hmm. say, yeah, I worked on Athera. That was basically what got me in the door at Paizo. Even though I'd done the Grand Convocation, that was never published. Mm-hmm. And I mean, other than the people that actually ran it, nobody really saw it, right? So but then once you do something, you can show that to the next people, and then you do something else. And I did stuff for Flaming Crab Games with James Gray was a great learning experience, and they were great enough to just sort of take me on as a pretty untried writer and gave me some stuff to work on. And basically, as you go through these different things, you learn each time, and you realize that it's not really about creativity. I mean, I think, you know, if I get to do an adventure path, then I think there's more creativity there because they don't give you as much of an outline. But in a society scenario, there's an outline. And so you're filling in the, well, not just filling in the blanks. I don't want to make it sound, you know, I don't want to minimize it, but you are following the ideas that are provided to you and then fleshing them out and things like that. So if you're able to write good prose and if you're able to come up with interesting stat blocks and interesting stories and things like that, then that's a really useful skill.
So, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned Ethereum a couple of times. I actually, one of the first things I did writing wise was conversions for Starfinder from that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, and kind of funny. Yeah, Ethereum was just such a, the timing was just so terrible. I mean,
that's what, you know, Jason said. Yeah.
Yeah. It launched and something like, you know, we turned in all the manuscripts. There was all this buzz and stuff like that. And then a couple of months later, Paizo announced Starfinder. And it's like, if we had had a couple of years of Ethereum being the sort of space pathfinder alternative, I think there would have been a lot more play on it. I've always felt bad for Robert Brooks and the rest of the team on that the timing just didn't work out. It's such a great campaign system. Wonderful worlds, a whole bunch of really interesting differences. Like there's no gods. There's no access to divine magic in Ethereum, which means all your healing tends to be much more Starfindery technology rather than, you know, wands of cure light wounds. So all these little sort of differences, and yet it still feels and plays like Pathfinder 1. So it's just a great system.
Yeah, I liked it. I'm shocked at how creative it is because I hadn't seen it until I interviewed Jason. And then he said he had something he needed some help with. So I was working on some stuff with him. But it's just amazing. And there's still so much there that could be done with it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, and I know that they have some bits and bobs that have come out from Legendary in terms of Ethereum. There was another book that got worked on. And I mean, it is still sort of being supported, but it's different enough from Starfinder that, you know, I think it has a slightly different audience. But I did some conversion of that for some of the monsters for Pathfinder 2nd and I think 5e as well. So, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to play Ethereum now.
Oh, the other question I had for you, kind of related to writing, is I'm kind of curious. You talked about just getting words on paper, spewing stuff out. What do you have a sense on what your daily output is on average? If you're sitting there turning and burning, how many words do you crank out in a day?
Yeah, you know, it's somewhere between 4,000 words at the top end and 6 words at the bottom end. It really varies. I find that I don't know if it's that I'm driven by deadline and that I'm a procrastinator or if I just let things percolate in my mind for a long time and don't put it down on paper, because once I put it down on paper, it sort of locks into place. It sort of exists in this quantum state in my head for the first half of the allotted time, I think. So for that first little while, I write an outline. If I come up with a neat phrase, or if I'm lucky enough to come up with an NPC name, I'll write that down. But it just tends to float around in my head for that first little while. And then I sit down and I spew out the first draft pretty much like I was binging a series. You know, I just sit down and over 3 or 4 days, I will write the entire thing in a poor draft. And then I'll think about it again for a little while. So I've got these spurts of really, really productive time. And then I've got these times when I'm literally not writing at all, even though I have, you know, time allocated for writing. Nothing actually goes down on the screen.
So yeah, that sounds a lot like academic writing. And that's the way I do it as well. And I'm an academic. I pretty think about it a lot, do an outline. As I get resources and things I think that might fit in, I'll just cut and paste them whole
into it.
And then I'll start paring it down to build some structure around what I have in there. Then I'll just write. And then, like you're saying, then I can just crank out a lot. If I try to sit and write without doing that, I have nothing to say.
Yeah, yeah. I find that it can be really hard to write early on because I've always sort of been, I mean, I do revise my work, obviously, but I tend to think that once I've put it down on paper, that character sort of exists, and and there's only so much that I'm willing to change them at that point. So I want to make sure that that first draft is kind of the right direction. Now, maybe that's limiting. You know, I'm certainly not a trained writer. I learned through university, and then I started writing planetarium shows at our museum. So basically, that, you know, totally different kind of communication. But although interestingly, I did have a talk at a conference with some people about how writing planetarium shows, the best training for that was being a dungeon master. So
that's
pretty much the same thing, just different content.
Yeah. You know, I tell people that, you know, I teach university. I said, that's really good training for being a dungeon master.
Oh yeah.
You know, so having to tell stories, keep people engaged, you know, all that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, there's a lot of similarities, and I think that's why, like, we're starting to see a lot of gaming stuff getting used in education systems through whether it's after school clubs, or I know some teachers that actually use RPGs in their classes. And then there's the whole, you know, historical side of things you could do. There's a lot of potential there for the gamification of acquiring knowledge, or the gamification of education. So, well,
yeah, have to see that was that really big, like 5 or 6 years ago. That was really kind of moving through both formal education and also the kind of informal stuff like seminars and business learning and stuff like that. But I haven't heard a lot about it lately, so I don't know.
I think what happened is it became a little difficult because, of course, when you're talking about a game, you got to have winners and losers or scores or things like that, and it's really hard to quantify the impact, like. You know, what impact was me being a gamer on my future career? Well, now looking back, I could tell you a bunch of things, but none of them will be just a simple checkbox on a survey or something that's easy to quantify into a numerical score, right? And so if it can't be measured, it doesn't exist, right?
Yeah, I actually have a full gaming resume that's completely separate from my professional resume. And so when I've applied for positions at gaming companies and stuff, that's what I would submit to them, you know?
Yeah. I have one that I sort of modify for whatever the client is. And I do occasionally forget to put things in or forget to take things out. So there'll be all of this gaming stuff. And then it'll say something about I have an asteroid named after me for being a astronomy educator. And it's like, that's really interesting, but why is that there? Oh, I just forgot to take it out of the resume.
Yeah. All right, so what's next for Scott? What kind of cool stuff are you working on that you can actually talk about now? And, and if you can't talk specifically about it, maybe say some general things.
Yeah, sure. Well, I did get to work recently on my first Paizo hardcover. Guns and Gears is coming out, and I wrote some stuff for that. And I mean, there's a long list of amazing people that worked on that. And it's pretty cool to see your name in the list with all these other amazing writers. So that was cool. And it was one of those ones where I sort of had to grow, because I got to say, I've never been a fan of guns in Pathfinder or in you know, D&D or anything like that. I've always sort of been a, you know, limited gun kind of guy. But taking that on and having to, you know, figure out how all this works and making it something that would be fun, I think it really forced me to sort of broaden my horizons, which I think was really useful. I probably wouldn't have written what I wrote for a home game because I just wouldn't have had that impetus, but you get an assignment and part of it is dealing with, you know, I was dealing with cannons. So I wrote some stuff about that, and I really had to push myself to get into it at first. And then once I did, I realized maybe this is something that works really well. And I started to get really excited about it. And the whole sort of steampunk feel to that book actually is really, really exciting.
Yeah, no, I look forward to that. I think that it's going to be really neat.
Yeah. As for other stuff, I mean, I'm still working on some conversion stuff for Legendary Games. That's sort of an ongoing thing, which is wonderful. Jason there is just so great at being able to, you know, give you a project and let you work on it as long as it takes, kind of thing. And sometimes I cranked out a whole bunch of stuff for them at once, and sometimes it takes a long time. But it's always a pleasure to work with them. And I do have one rather large project that I'm working on that has to remain unnamed for right now. But the word count was up over 50,000 words, which is by far the biggest thing that I've ever done. And
is this for Paizo or somebody else?
I'm not at liberty to say at this point, but it's a pretty big project, and I'm really excited about it. I'm just getting ready to turn over the final in the next couple of weeks. So I'm going through and trying to finally figure out all those NPC names, because they gotta get names before you send them in, right? They can't all be Bob.
Wow. For sure. For sure. Well, excellent. Well, Scott, this has been a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
No problem. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot.